Welcome to the ESI Report, brought to you by Krolon Track, the industry leader in data recovery, information management, electronic discovery, and legal technology products and services. Hear the latest information to help lawyers manage electronic evidence accurately and cost-effectively in a changing legal world. You're listening to the Legal Talk Network.
Thanks for tuning in to another edition of the ESI Report. I am Michelle Lang, host of this legal technology podcast. On today's show, we will take an in-depth look at how lawyers and experts are leveraging information science in arguments regarding the effectiveness of technology-assisted review, or TAR, keyword search, and everything in between. Also, don't miss our Bits and Bytes legal analysis, in which we will have special correspondents from Krolon Track revisit the clean products case and examine how this case is critical in the development of the TAR case law. But first, let's get started with all the ESI buzz, the part of the show where we update listeners on the latest e-discovery happenings, catch up with industry experts, and discuss the legal technology news you need to know.
Now, here's the ESI buzz.
Searching for documents is a critical phase of discovery. It defines the deck of cards that the parties will play throughout litigation. But despite the importance of search, attorneys struggle over what constitutes a sufficient disclosure. For example, when a party requests all relevant documents, do you really need to produce all relevant documents? Further, as new search technologies continue to enter the market, we have grown accustomed to bold promises about their unrivaled accuracy. But what are these statements grounded on? More blatantly, does search accuracy really matter? Internationally renowned e-discovery expert Ralph Losey, partner at Jackson Lewis, is here today with me to delve into these murky issues of search. We are going to talk about accuracy, technology-assisted review, and we might even do a little math. Hi, Ralph. It's Michelle Lang with the ESI Report. Great to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, Ralph, there are infinite ways to search a body of documents, and I was hoping that before we dive into search effectiveness, you could just give us a little bit of the landscape of some of the different search tools. What are parties using today to, in 2012, to get from point A, which is really a big corpus of documents, to point B, which is the goal, a stack of responsive documents ready for discovery production?
Well, you know, this is my favorite subject, Michelle, so I'm happy to talk to you about that this morning. Before we get into the various methods of search, I just wanted to pick up a little bit on your analogy about the deck of cards. Because we're still seeing a lot of cases out there where attorneys think that it is their responsibility to be advocates and not only to try and sell what the hand they're dealt means and you know the legal significance of the facts, but some attorneys are still trying to play the game of changing the cards they were dealt. And that's, you know, sanctions is still a huge issue. And one thing we've just got to remember as lawyers is, you play the cards that you're dealt. You don't try and change them. You don't try and hide them. And so it's a matter of a good faith effort to find out really what the cards are, what the relevant information is, and turn it over to the other side. If it's really all that bad and you get a hand you know you're going to lose on, well, then you can always fold. You know, you can settle the case, but you cannot hide the cards. And that's a lot of what search is about, is this good faith, the building up trust between the requesting party and responding party that they are going to show the right cards. And that's kind of a hidden driving point behind a lot of the issues that we're seeing nowadays in search. So with that said, I think what most lawyers are still doing, believe it or not, is still doing manual review. And that's the way lawyers have been doing it since the days of Abraham Lincoln. They're actually being handed a file, they're looking through that file, and they're using their skills as a lawyer in order to determine what's relevant and what isn't. Because the vast majority of cases, you know, are not big federal cases. They're small cases in state court. And that's why e-discovery is really not even being done by the vast majority of lawyers today. They're still doing like Abe Lincoln and doing a just manual review of limited amounts of paper. But those of us who are involved in other kind of cases where you're not just handed a paper file, but really you're told that there is no file that's been organized on this matter. There's no file, for instance, that says antitrust discussions. You know, it just doesn't work that way in sophisticated litigation. So if you're handed a file at all, you're handed maybe emails, and you're not handed a few thousand emails. If you only had a few thousand emails, then this expert manual review would work, and it would work fine. But unfortunately, for many of us, we're handed a few million emails. And there, the traditional method of just looking at every email, looking at every document, it no longer works. And so that's, you know, the profession realized this quite some time ago in the 90s, the turn of the century, early 2000. They knew they had to get beyond regular expert manual review. And that's where keyword search was born. And that's the second method that a lot of lawyers still think is really state of the art. But we've known from the very get-go when keyword search first started being used in the 90s, actually a study was done sponsored by Blair and Moran in the late 80s, that keyword search doesn't work in the sense it doesn't have a very good recall. And maybe we'll get into what that means, although I think most of your listeners probably know that recall means how much of the relevant evidence we're finding. So we've known all along that keyword search has limited effectiveness because of the vagaries of language, misspelling, a million reasons. And it really only gets maybe 20%, 30%, 40% at best of the relevant information when you're talking about large volumes of data and chaotic data, which is mainly what we're dealing with.
So some of these limitations of keyword searching has really resulted in alternative technologies that we can use to try and gain a better understanding of what's in those documents.
That's right. And there's several other more advanced search methods that I'd like to talk about. But before we move off of keyword search is still a valuable method to use. It just has to be used in a more sophisticated manner. You have to read Judge Peck's gross construction case where he points out the obvious basics, like talk to the witnesses involved and find out what language they use. Look at key documents and find out what language is used. And use more sophisticated than just search a word. Actually test the words and do what's called a parametric search, and that is searching different fields. Like just search, limit your search to subject matter, for instance, or limit your search in the to and from, or limit your search to different metadata fields. And then, of course, use Boolean connectors. This word within 10 of that word, or this word but not that word. So there's more to Boolean search. You know, even that gets more advanced. Make it parametric, selective fields, and make it Boolean. And then be knowledgeable before you start using the words and test the words. When you do all of those things, well, keyword search can be much more effective. And maybe you can get beyond the 20% into the 40%, 50%. But still, there's a limitation inherent in most cases, not all. Sometimes there's a case that's just about a strange name. And you know what? Everything with that name in it is going to get most of what you want. So although I am, you know, pretty adamant that you should go beyond keyword search in every case, there are some cases where it's just fine. And so I want to, you know, stick up for keyword search while I say that still its older brothers and more advanced technologies can take you further.
So what are some of
the more advanced technologies that I think you want me to talk about, Michelle, are things like similarity, where, you know, not just identical, but near duplication of documents, so you can show the computer some documents that you found are relevant, and the computer will go out and search for things that are similar in word count, word structure. And then even a higher level, more advanced, is so-called concept searching, where it's using like latent semantic indexing, linguistic models. So it may not even be the same words, may not even look the same, but it's using the same concepts. And so this is going way beyond keyword search. And until a few years ago, that was the state of the art. The final where we're at now, though, the most advanced we have so far is predictive coding. And that's, of course, my very favorite topic at the moment.
So before we dig into predictive coding, talk a little bit more for those of us that perhaps don't understand some of the terminology that you were throwing out there, recall, precision, you know, some of us hear F measure. What do these words mean, and why should lawyers care about them?
Yeah, I mean, we'll use the original language that kind of developed naturally out of a keyword search. When you would have a dirty search, we used to call it, it means it would have all kinds of false hits. It would have the word you were looking for, but it wouldn't have anything to do with your case. And when you had, a lot of bad hits that came up, and only a few of the documents with the keywords were actually what you were looking for, that's actually called, in information science, that's called precision. And so if your keyword combination, maybe your parametric Boolean layout, is such that it has hits where 90% of the hits are actually relevant, that means you have what's called a 90% precision. And so you're not wasting your time looking at a lot of relevant documents, and so you're saving money. On the other hand, you may have 90% of the documents that have the keyword hit be relevant, but you may be missing a whole lot of other relevant documents that don't happen to use those keywords. And there, let's say you're only finding 10% of the relevant documents. So that's where the word recall comes in. Recall means how much of the total relevant documents is your search capturing. So if you only captured 10% of the relevant documents, you would have a recall rate of only 10%, which is not very good. Like I say, studies have shown keyword search, regular keyword search, is only getting about 20%, which means 80% of the evidence that's responsive is left on the table. F measure is a fancy way of combining the two in a harmonic mean, a mathematical way, so that you're trying to come up with a measurement that includes both precision and recall. And this seems to be, what we're moving towards now most of the time, is a balance between precision, which means efficiency, and recall, which means completeness. So that's what we're looking for.
So how are courts dealing with this, and how are lawyers arguing using these various information science principles when it comes to discovery and the use of technology-assisted review? I think we can assume that everyone understands generally what technology-assisted review is. Ralph, let's try to dig under the covers a little bit more and really explain, where do the numbers need to be with regards to, so that you can claim that you have effectively done your job of searching through a pile of documents.
Right. And that goes back to your original question of the rules in all relevant documents. And the truth is, the rules have never required all relevant documents, because that rule has always been considered in conjunction with Rule 26B2C, the so-called proportionality rule that has to do with what is an undue burden. And so it's never been required that you get all the truth, because you just need enough truth to do justice in a case. Because to find all the truth, let's say, may cost more money than is actually at issue in the case. So there's always the balance of proportionality. And proportionality as a term, as a doctrine, is relatively new. It's only been talked about for the past 4 or 5 years. But it's been embedded in the law for 40 years or more. It just, they didn't talk about proportionality. They just talked about undue burden, because that's how old Rule 26D2C is. And that's a balancing between the cost and the burden and the benefit. It's a cost-benefit analysis that's always been in the rules, along with Rule 1, which is the primary, prime directive, if you will, of procedural rules. And that requires that it be speedy, and inexpensive. A resolution of disputes. So we're in the face of an avalanche of information that we now have, this flood of information where we're faced with millions of emails, that some of which may not be relevant. This is coming into play more and more, in that we really want to go for the most bang for your buck. We want to get the most relevant documents, which is why one of my slogans to try and explain all of this sounds like a Zen koan, but it's relevant is irrelevant. In other words, just getting relevant information, that's not really that important anymore. Because if you've ever done a search project, you know you can find an email that makes a point, and then you'll find another email that makes the same point, and then you'll find 10,000 other emails that make the same point. Well, how many emails do you need to make the same point? You really only need a few. And if you're at trial, there's such a thing as objection cumulative. And we got to remember, e-discovery is to prepare for trial. So there's no reason to keep on finding every which way to prove the same point. Once you've proven it, you've proven it. Move on. And that's why what's really key to me, and I think we're going to be focusing in on more and more now, is the highly relevant. We want searches that will find what's really highly relevant, the key documents that are needed to prove up your case.
So if you're using these tools, and whether, you know, I think as an industry, we really haven't settled on what we're going to call this yet, predictive coding, TAR, CAR, computer-assisted review, machine learning, intelligent review, smart review, there's about a million different terms for it. But at the end of the day, if you're using one of these technologies, what are you really looking for in order to drive effectiveness? Doesn't need to be 100% because the rules don't require that, because of reasonableness and burden versus benefit, like you talked about, but is 1% effective?
1% recall probably not going to be acceptable. And by the way, I just want to lobby for the word CAR, computer assisted review, because TAR, I don't like the sound of it. I like computer assisted review because one of the measurements that we do is files per hour. And so that's the phrase I'm lobbying for. I do hope as an industry we do settle on a phrase pretty soon, but you got to remember this is all kind of new. But CAR, TAR, whatever you want to call it, you need to get more than 1%. But it is ridiculous to think that you're going to get 100%. And one of the main things that I found interesting in studying information science is the inability to measure very effectively when you're dealing with large amounts of data. And so the truth is, you don't really know how accurate any of your measurements are, because the so-called gold standard of human beings, what I started the expert manual review, the way we used to look at pieces of paper, it's no longer effective when you start talking about millions of documents and you start talking about reviewers manually reviewing hundreds of thousands of documents. The human review is itself very inaccurate. The recent study by the eDiscovery Institute, where they took a work done by Verizon doing a second review where they looked at 6 million documents, and they were done by contract reviewers. Well, that when they went back and did a quality control study of that, they found that the reviewers themselves, the manual reviewers, disagreed with each other 72% of the time. They only agreed 28% of the time. So think of that. That means that the manual review to measure this is wrong, you know, about 80% of the time. And so how are you even going to know that your effectiveness is at such a rate? Are you going to have contract reviewers actually review all of them? Well, if they do, that's no good. Are you going to do keyword search? That's no good. And so what they found is, in studying the limits of measurement, it turns out that you can only know something in the neighborhood of 60 to 70% accuracy of whether you have recall in large databases, because you can't, there is no way to measure it. So I think it is not going to be realistic to expect lawyers to be able to show that they retrieve more than 60 or 70%. And in fact, in the TREC, legal TREC test, The best performing ones are in the 70%, maybe 80%. And even there, who knows once you get past 70 whether that measurement is accurate. Now, I know this is a little kind of, you know, hard to understand the measurement stuff. So I have written on this at length at the eDiscovery team, my blog, if you want to delve into it further. But it just has to do with the limits of measurement.
So talk a little bit then about how the technology, if you do only hit a 50% recall, should you scrap the whole review and start over again? Or how do you drive up your accuracy or your recall?
Well, this is where quality control and best practices come into play. You've got it no matter what search technique you're using. And I personally believe you should use all of them. I promote what I call multimodal. You use a little bit of manual review, you use keyword search, you use similarity, concept search, and predictive coding. You use all of them. When you use it, you're doing quality control all along. You're doing random sampling at the beginning, random sampling at the end, to get an idea of how much relevant information there may be in the database you're looking at, which is a word for that, scientific word, a common word actually is yield. More scientific word is prevalence. So if you're looking at, let's say you're given 100,000 emails to look at, you do a random sample of it and you find that 10% of them are indeed relevant, that gives you an idea to know, a goal of how many relevant documents are going to be in the larger set. And so although you'll never get all 100% of those relevant, it'll give you an idea of how many you can recover. So this is called a random sample, use of random sample for quality control. That is one way that you can test and know that you're finding as much information as possible. The other way is unique to predictive coding. And the advanced analytics do allow for ranking of documents. And in your quality control, what you're looking for is to make sure that all highly relevant documents have been retrieved. So when I do a search, when I test it, and before I decide I'm done, I've found enough, I do random sample testing to make sure that I haven't omitted, excluded from what I'm going to review, anything that's highly relevant. If I find that I have, and the random sample comes up with one highly relevant, well, then I've got to go back and search some more before I consider my search project complete. So it becomes a change of emphasis in that if I've omitted a relevant document that I've already seen 10 times before in different shades of gray, I don't care. But if I find an outlier, a brand new relevant document, or I find a highly relevant document, then I do care. Then you continue the search. So this is the kind of quality control methods that people are developing in order to meet their requirement of reasonability under the rules.
So, Ralph, as we wrap up, where do you think this is all headed? What do you think document review is going to look like 5 years from now? 20 years from now is maybe too far out, but when all of this sort of settles down, what do you think the world's going to look like?
Well, I think we're going to be doing less and less of the paper manual review. And now, like I say, I started off, most lawyers are still doing paper manual review. In 5 years, I expect a dramatic shift, finally. And I think it'll now be a minority of lawyers will just be doing paper. That will be huge in itself and will require a lot of assistance from vendors and experts in the field to help the vast majority of the bar come into the 21st century. So that's going to happen. The second thing is people are going to get away from just doing keyword search. They're going to understand that is not state of the art. And in 5 years, I think predictive coding will be quite common. I think in 5 years, there will be well-established best practices of how you do a multimodal search that includes predictive coding, includes certain quality control. Towards that end, I've been working hard, as you know, developing best practices for lawyers, even created a website where this information is all given out, EDBP, Electronic Discovery Best Practices, EDBP.com, and you'll see I'm collecting best practices in all aspects of e-discovery, not just search, but certainly search is one of the key parts. So I think more and more attorneys will be adopting best practices. And then in addition to that, you're going to find attorneys and vendors particularly doing more than just having best practices, which are something that you strive for, but there's going to be the development of a standard minimum practices, standards that you have to do this, or frankly, you might be doing malpractice. You may be negligent if you don't do this. The day may come, and it may come soon, when a lawyer is found to be negligent for not looking at his client's email and just instead looking at only at the paper printouts of some email. We're not there yet, but I think that's likely to happen. And other standards will be developed, things like standards for deduplication, standards for review and how people are trained, other minimum levels, which is something different than best standards. So I see that coming in the next 5 years, that the whole bar is going to move more into e-discovery. We're going to have minimum standards that you have to do this, like Judge Shindlin is saying, you have to give a written notice. That is a minimum standard already in her court, not yet the whole country. And other things like that are base minimums. And then beyond that, there'll be things that practice you'll strive for, the actual best practice that will also, I think, be widely emulated by attorneys who are doing e-discovery.
Well, Ralph, we've come to the end of our time. Thank you for this enlightening discussion for our listeners.
Well, I thank you, and I hope everyone gets away from the game of Go Fish and instead plays more of Where's Waldo and use the computer to help you find all the relevant information. It's really a lot of fun when you get into it.
I love it. Love it. Thanks, Ralph. That was Ralph Losey, e-discovery expert and partner at Jackson Lewis. For more ESI news and information, sign up for the e-discovered, rediscovered newsletter by Kroll On Track, available in the resource library at krolontrack.com.
Is your organization considering bringing e-discovery in-house? Traditional e-discovery software solutions typically require a sizable upfront investment, installation time, and IT training. The Verve SaaS platform, powered by Kroll On Track, can be up and running quickly at a predictable, transparent cost. Find out what Verve DIY eDiscovery can do for you. Visit www.krolontrack.com/Verve for more details. Now back to this edition of the ESI Report for today's Bits and Bytes legal analysis.
Today's Bits and Bytes segment, we are going to take a look at the case Clean Products versus Packaging Corp of America. Clean Products was a major candidate for a TAR acceptance case early in 2012, but it fell out of the spotlight with limited developments during the spring and summer. It wasn't until August 2012 when the case would resurface after the parties came to an understanding not to use technology-assisted review. Elliot Westman, Kroll On Track legal correspondent, joins me today to examine the developments in Clean Product and revisit whether this is a failed TAR case or just a diamond in the rough.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
So, Elliot, can you describe the underlying facts and procedural posture of the case, and especially some of the stuff going on this fall in 2012?
Sure. So it's a class action based on the plaintiff's allegations that the defendants engaged in anti-competitive behavior within the containerboard industry. The case was first filed in September 2010. It didn't really start gaining traction in the e-discovery community until January, when it was transferred to Magistrate Judge Nan Nolan for discovery supervision. In February and March, Judge Nolan held several evidentiary conferences regarding a search dispute that arose after the defendants had begun producing responses to initial requests. Essentially, the plaintiffs wanted a redo. The plaintiffs felt that the defendants' Boolean-based search wasn't sufficiently accurate. Instead, they urged the court to require the defendants to use TAR.
And how did the defense argue that their Boolean search was effective?
Well, the defendants conceded that keyword searches are frequently problematic. So, for example, a keyword search could be too narrow and miss a lot of relevant documents, having poor recall, or it could be too broad and include a lot of non-responsive documents with the responsive documents, and that's poor precision. However, the defendants went on to show how their implementation of Boolean search addressed these concerns.
So what were some of the specific concerns?
Well, for one, the defendants engaged in an iterative search. So presumably what they did was a first round of keyword search. Then they looked through the hits to see if their keyword list was catching too many non-responsive documents. And then they sampled the misses to see if they were missing too many responsive documents. And this allows the defendants to tweak their search methodology by adding keywords to their list or modifying existing keywords. And this is really essential to defensible search. Parties who don't perform any testing are very vulnerable to challenges like the one made here. They also received input from co-defendants as well as the plaintiffs regarding which keywords to use. Evidence suggested that the defendants incorporated some of these alterations in their master keyword list. And then finally, according to the defendant's expert, they actually reviewed 99% or more of the documents that had emerged from the Boolean search at the time of the February 21st evidentiary hearing.
So then what did the plaintiffs use to argue that the production should have been done using technology-assisted review?
Well, they pointed to various studies that discuss keyword search and TAR search in discovery settings. So at a very basic level, they contrasted the difference between traditional Boolean search, which requires exact matches between phrases in the keyword search and the documents, to supervised learning, where a machine learns by human example which documents are responsive and non-responsive. The plaintiffs submitted that using TAR or TAR over Boolean search would result in a richer, more accurate return. They also discussed some of the results of TREK in order to demonstrate the accuracy of TAR. So another source that the plaintiffs leveraged to attack the defendant's Boolean search was a frequently cited study by Blair and Marone, where attorneys thought that they were retrieving 75% of responsive documents based on keyword search, but really they're only getting 25%. So just to kind of show the discrepancy between what people think their keywords are getting and what they're actually getting. And then they also attacked the human sampling and quality control done by the defendants as being potentially biased and thus skewing recall rates.
So here we are in the fall of 2012, and a lot of this occurred over the last 9 months or so since the beginning of 2012. This case has had a fairly interesting ending, or at least a fairly interesting turn of events. Here we are in November of 2012. Can you update
us? Absolutely. Yep. Judge Nolan expressed that she didn't want to put the defendant's work to waste by making them start over, and she hoped that the parties would be able to cooperate and come up with an agreeable solution. Soon after, the dispute was resolved by party stipulation. The plaintiffs totally abandoned their arguments, urging defendants to redo search using TAR for productions before October 1st, 2013. Notably, however, the parties are expected to meet and confer after October 1st, 2013, regarding the appropriate search methodology for future collections. So that's going to be kind of the tipping point, whether these arguments are going to come back later when that date comes, or whether they're going to be abandoned, or if they're going to meet and confer and do something totally different. And then, as you were talking about, as a side note, the most recent development in this case was a discovery order on September 28th, where Judge Nolan discussed the importance of proportionality and cooperation to the decision.
So, Elliot, right now where we're hanging on every possible case that's mentioning, or every judicial mention of technology-assisted review, computer-assisted review, predictive coding, intelligent review, whatever you call it, why doesn't this case stand against the adoption of TAR? Why is this case important?
I think that taken as a whole, this decision really goes above and beyond some of the other TAR opinions out there. So not only are we getting literally hundreds of pages of transcripts where some of the brightest experts in this new area of law and technology are discussing TAR and the various benefits to using it, but we get to see how a court balances the tension between requiring a party to use a potentially more accurate search, that'd be TAR here, or allowing a party to conduct a search as they see fit. Here, that'd be the Boolean search.
So what are some of the crucial takeaways from this case?
I think that one of the things that really comes out in this case is that it isn't just a numbers game. Sifting through the evidentiary hearings, it's really hard not to dwell on the statistics that arguably show TAR can perform better than Boolean search, particularly in these massive multi-million document cases. But it's crucial to understand that the court will not require parties to use TAR because it may have done the job faster and cheaper. So as Judge Nolan put it, quote, "We all know every court in the country has used Boolean search. I mean, this isn't like some freak thing that the defendants picked out." And then Judge Nolan also put a lot of weight on Sedona Principle 6, which states, quote, "Responding parties are best situated to evaluate the procedures, methodologies, and technologies appropriate for preserving and producing their own electronically stored information." So this citation made it clear that she was going to give some deference to the defendants if the dispute continued.
Interesting. So besides Judge Nolan's reference to Sedona Principle 6, what other concepts did she touch on or would have addressed if the parties had never came to this agreement?
So as we've seen in some of the other big TAR cases, search is all about reasonableness, and this fits in right with Principle 6. In defining a reasonable search, metrics like recall, precision, they're very helpful, but it's key to remember that a search can be reasonable even if there exists a more accurate or cheaper method of search. Here, defendants did a really impressive job of Boolean search. They had quality control in place, and they had input from opposition on keywords. This is so much more defensible than most of the Boolean searches that we see or that are done in current practice without testing. Additionally, the defendants had already produced millions of documents using their Boolean methodology. If no one would have required defendants to re-review all those documents, the order would have essentially put all the defendants' work to waste. So this really isn't a TAR rejecting case in any respect. It says that keyword search isn't dead. You can still use your iPhone 4S even though the iPhone 5 is out.
Good analogy. So why do we even have technology-assisted review, and why is this the hottest thing of 2012 then with regards to improving the efficiency of document review if, in this case, Judge Nolan is saying, you know what, Boolean search was okay?
Well, just because you can use TAR over Boolean search doesn't mean you should. And there are a lot more differences between Boolean search and TAR than the iPhone 5 and the iPhone 4S. Some of the biggest drivers for TAR are the cost savings and accuracy. When the cases are in the millions of documents, like they were here in Clean, if you can cut out review of 30 to 50% of the documents, that's a huge number of cost savings. In fact, if you want a great discussion of why to use TAR, check out the plaintiff's expert testimony and the transcripts in this case.
Well, Elliot, thank you so much. Thank you for walking through our listeners of the developments in this exciting case. And I have a feeling it's not over. Like you said, this was an opportunity for us to read pages and pages of transcripts of some of the brightest minds when it comes to machine learning and technology-assisted review. And we're certainly just at the tip of the iceberg when it comes to defining best practices around this technology. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yep, absolutely. My pleasure, Michelle.
Hey, listeners, do you know that Kroll on Track offers a free online library of thought-leading ESI resources? If you're looking for upcoming legal technology programs or recent ESI case law, visit krolontrack.com/resources. Well, it looks like we've come to the end of another great show. I'd like to give special thanks today to our guests, Ralph Lucy of Jackson Lewis and special correspondent Elliot Westman. Join us next time as we continue discussing cutting-edge ESI issues on the ESI Report. Until then, I'm Michelle Lang, reminding you that when you think ESI, think Kroll on Track.
The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Legal Tech Network, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.
Thanks for listening to the ESI Report here on Legal Talk Network. Visit KrollonTrack.com to learn more about the e-discovery, computer forensic, data recovery, and consulting services and solutions offered by Kroll on Track today.